Welcome to a new conversation about software engineering today with Sarah Wells. Very nice to have you on the show. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. Thank you for inviting me.
Sarah is an independent consultant who used to work as a technical director, right, for Financial Times.
Yes.
Yeah. I worked for the Financiële Dagblad, which is kind of the same thing in the Netherlands. So that's the reason why I was always like a bit alert when I saw your talks, because you're a prolific speaker, right? At high profile conferences, I would say, QCon London, Go to Copenhagen, KraftConf in Budapest, LeadDev, you know, everywhere where it's cool, you're there. And also the author of the book Enabling Microservice Success, where I thought, I mean, we talked about it a couple of minutes ago, you know, yet another book about microservices. I don't need to read it. And then I bought it. I bought it accidentally, actually, because it was part of a Humble bundle. And for some reason, I had to check something. I was like, maybe it's in the book. And then, you know, I read in the book and I was like, oh, this is really cool. And we have to talk.
Excellent. Okay. Excellent.
All right. Yeah, I prepared an outline, but last week I had a conversation with Birgitta Böckeler, who is distinguished engineer at ThoughtWorks. And we talked about the retreat in Utah, Future of Software Engineering. And now, you know, now I have to address immediately when we talk about, I didn't say what we want to talk about. We want to talk about technology governance and maybe a bit of technology strategy. And it's also a part in your book. So highly recommended, you know, you buy it. Yeah. And but one thing, you know, when you approach new technology, it's usually slow, and we can talk about it, but right now it's like a flood of new tools.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with all those new incoming AI tools?
I mean, it's a real challenge. It's particularly difficult because there's all of these tools. Everybody's scared of missing out. There's fear of missing out in companies. Do we need to get the right tool? We need to be using it. There's also fear of missing out from the people that are building AI tools. So they're getting them out there as quickly as possible. So I don't think you can rely on the fact that they have really thought deeply about the security of the thing that they're building. You know, they're startups, a lot of them. So you've got a couple of things there where everyone's trying to rush. And yet these are tools that have access to the crown jewels of your data. Like to work, they need access to all of the information that you have. So if things go wrong, that's absolutely terrifying. And there was an incident the latter half of last year where an AI tool that was integrated with Salesforce called Drift got compromised. And effectively, people's Salesforce instances were having lots of data exfiltrated. And that's really quite terrifying. But it's a very valuable tool for people. It was a widget on the website that would allow people to book calls in to talk about about buying software, and had an impact on people's bottom line. So you've got to try and find a way to not stop people from getting an advantage that might be quite a big business advantage. I've actually been working with a client about looking at this, and one of the things we've been doing is doing threat modeling for the things that are bought in to the company, so that at least you're saying, well, here's the data flows, here's the data that's going to be used by this, understanding where it fits into your system, and saying, here's what we can do to try and make sure that we are as protected as possible. So the questions you could ask to the people that you're buying from, the questions you can ask the people that are integrating it in your company.
Yeah, I was more looking at development tools. So
it's the same thing with development tools, right? Yeah, so you still should be thinking, is this a tool that we should be using? Do we have a contract with this company? Are we sending out their data? Are they using it for training? All of those things as well. Developers aren't thinking this. Many developers are using AI tools that are not, they're using their personal accounts. So companies don't even know what tools developers are using in their organization.
So as an
organization, you probably want to try and work out what's being used in your by someone in your company.
I recently had a conversation with an AI strategist, whatever that means, right? And I was surprised that I think it was the second thing he was mentioning was the shadow IT problem with AI. Because everyone is building certain tools for, you know, themselves, or like you say, you know, they use it with a private account, also with one of my customers. I was really shocked that they, I cannot even say what they're doing, but it's really, it's reckless. It's a bit scary.
I think it's just making much easier to do things that people might have done in the past, where I've worked in organizations pre-AI where a developer with a credit card could go and buy a tool and start using it, and you had no kind of contract with that company or any real knowledge centrally that your organization was using this tool. We would sometimes have people get in touch with us at the FT saying, did you know that you've got 10 people using this tool? It's like, maybe not. So you do have to, I think AI tools and the fact that everyone can just be using it, one thing you can do is be very clear about what your policies are around AI use. So I have worked with a client who basically said, okay, we really want to benefit from AI, but you can use these tools. And the mechanisms for adding other tools is like this. And we expect you to only use the tools that have been approved. Or if you want something else, you have to tell us about it. And at least then people kind of are going to pause a bit because they're going to think, well, if I don't follow this policy, I'm actually... this is potentially a serious issue for me. You know, it's like it's basically part of the things you signed up to say, I will follow these policies. It's not very exciting to say that, but I think for this organization, you want to progress. You always want to be clear with governance. What are you expecting from people? Like, what do you, if you tell people what is fine, then, and what isn't fine, then there's no ability to say, oh, I didn't realize I couldn't just start using this tool.
I think, you know, what I found interesting in your book was you had this tech governance group, and I was like, oh, we should try this, you know, at the company I work for and the clients I work with. But before we talk about this tech governance group, how can I strategically come up with let's say a technology selection? How would I do that?
In an organization choosing?
Yeah, so for example, in your book, I think it was in your book, you know, you were mentioning Wortley mapping as one thing, but I you know, that would be one thing, but there are probably also others.
So I think you start with the business problem. And you think about, is this something that we should build or could we buy it? And where Wortley mapping comes in, the idea that you know, you really should be investing your time as a technology team building things that are differentiated for your business, things your customers care about. And this is something that when I was at the FT, it was really interesting because we had a bit of we had an explosion of everyone was autonomous and everyone wants to build things themselves. So we had two teams that were building a Kubernetes platform. Not one, two different, but it wasn't for everybody. Other people were using different things. This is great, but it's not the business of the Financial Times. It's not a container orchestration company. It's a newspaper. So really you should be spending time building the things that are about your business and that are differentiators for you. Now, it might be that you know, there isn't anything that you can buy that will give you a particular benefit of hosting or something like that, but eventually you get to the point where those the things that you're building on top of become products, they become commodities. So it started out everyone built were starting to use Docker, they were building their own container orchestration, then Kubernetes came along, then gradually people were doing managed Kubernetes for you, and so it becomes something where you might still want to build yourself a platform, but actually maybe you're better off getting someone else to build and run it for you. So focusing on the new things that you build and the places where you try innovative technologies are the things that are really critical to you as a company, because there's much more risk where you're trying something that's people haven't used before. So I love it. It's now, I think it's a decade old, but the idea of boring technology that Dan McKinley wrote about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which is such a great article and conference talk, and so many bits to it. But I love the innovation tokens, the idea that you have to choose which bits where you use your innovation. You don't have the ability to innovate in five different places at the same time.
Yeah, so choose a boring technology. I like it if I run, I'm usually running the software I develop, but I also know a lot of, graduates, junior developers who want to use the hottest stuff. So I would agree, we should use boring technology, at least, if other people have tried it and it works, then it's great.
But I'm not saying, yeah. So you're absolutely right, that there has got to be space to try new things.
Exactly.
I used to write EJBs. We're not still building Java systems using EJBs. It's like you move on. And so having the ability to say, there's this new thing. It looks really cool. It might solve our problem much more quickly. It is something that's worth looking at. But you just have to try and find ways for people to try it out without going full scale into some new technology and without knowing how it's going to work.
But when you say you want people to go into new technology, I mean, if you want to try out, you don't really know in the beginning how it's going to work, do you?
No, I think what I want is for the space for recognizing when something's starting to get to the point where it could be useful for us. So maybe it's not bleeding edge anymore. The FTE were quite comfortable with leading edge stuff. So someone would say, hey, this sounds really good. Could we try this out? And actually, my team used to do... we used to do a 10% day where you could effectively try anything you liked. And we'd say, well, it needs to be something that is relevant to us, could help us. And you have to present back. You have to say what you're going to investigate, and then you have to present back. And that was really great for people saying, hey, I've found this new technology. I think it's really, really fantastic. I'm going to spend a day on it. And sometimes they would come back and say, yeah, this is really good. And more often they would come back and say, yeah, once I actually tried to do something with it, it didn't work quite the way that I was hoping, I've concluded it's not going to be the future.
Yeah, I mean, we have that, but very often it's like, yeah, this tool is so cool. And now the new AI whatever tools, right? Mm. And the new spec-driven thing, and of course, in the private, if you play around, it might be cool, but then the question is also, yeah, you're enthusiastic, but...
Yeah, that's where it's always good. It's good when you're doing it in the context of a real problem. It's good when you're thinking, well, will it solve a problem our team is facing right now? And that was a nice constraint on it, was we want to see, would it fit?
Ah, okay. Yeah, that helps. Yeah, you mentioned the innovation tokens. By accident, one of my co-hosts here, Alex Heusingfeld, he also once wrote an article about innovation tokens, but maybe not everyone knows what innovation tokens are.
Yeah, so the idea is that it comes from Dan McKinley. Let's imagine you've got three tokens that you can spend on innovation. What are you going to spend them on? Like, you probably want to spend them on the things that are most valuable to your business. You probably don't want to build a time series database for your observability system. People who are enthusiastic engineers will often suggest things like that. I had a team that wanted to build CI/CD using serverless components. And it's like, well, okay, you could build something that's amazing, but is it going to be so much more amazing that it's going to transform our business in any way? Or is it going to be 5% better than 5% better than what we could just buy? So the idea is that you don't try and do very innovative things too many at the same time. Because actually, it's risky. It takes a bit more time. It's a lot of mental capacity. It's like, it's just a cognitive load that you just have to not take on too much.
Yeah, and how do you choose the amount of tokens? I mean, you said 3 tokens for a team per year.
I genuinely think at any time you really ought to be only really thinking about doing one thing. Having said that, I worked on a team where we switched programming language, graph database, and hosting platform at the same time. And we succeeded. And all of those things were quite new. So there's always a case for thinking, maybe this will work for us. But I think you only really want to be doing one thing where it's brand new. And everything else you want to be quite predictable and you understand it and we know how to do this. Just because it's hard to learn many things at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, last week with Birgitta, we had also the problem. You know, so many new tools in the AI space, and you have to break and start slowly. For a certain amount of time, people were always talking about, we just use the best tool for the job, right? And I was also in at a company. They said use the best tool for the job, and it did sound good in the beginning, but very quickly I thought this is the worst idea I've ever experienced.
So when you say best tool for the job, are you saying that anybody chooses different databases and different...
Yeah. Exactly. It was just too many technologies. We had 10 teams and 8 different pipeline technologies, something like that. And the question is, how do I balance? How would you balance this? You need governance, right? So to do that.
Definitely. I think... I've been in that organization, you know, I've been in that place where we had 3 of everything, and it's costly in a lot of ways. You can't really build common capabilities if there are 3 different programming languages and 5 different databases.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I think you have to be clear about what is the standard set of technologies that you should, you know, reach for most cases, and how do you make the decision that you need something different in this particular case. So there will be cases where you basically go, I need a different kind of database than the ones we're using elsewhere, and here are the reasons why this is important. This is going back a long time, but at the time there was a point at the FT where we're using relational databases, but we were building something where we wanted to model metadata about articles, and it's a graph, and it is so much easier to build software about metadata when you use a graph database than it is to stick it into a relational database. It's just it just fits the problem space. So I would have said, you know, I would say in that case, you absolutely do want to choose the best tool for the job there, because it's going to make such a big difference to you. But I think there are other places where it comes back to that business differentiator thing. So at one point I discovered that we had a team at the FT that were sending their logs to a completely different logging stack. And I found this out during an incident where I couldn't see the logs from this team because it wasn't in the standard logging stack, because they decided to send them somewhere else. So I think there are generally places where you need to say, actually, that we get a lot of benefit from being on a single type of technology for solving this problem.
Yeah, interesting that you say that, because you said you have to think about how many technologies you want to support. So I once was part of a platform team, and we provided service templates. And the problem is, of course, if you only have Java, for example, it's easy. But we had 4 different stacks. And then you basically can't, right? So we just say, well, we support Java and we support this and that and the rest, bad luck. And I thought, until you mentioned it, I thought, well, it's fine to give people some choices in terms of technology, because there was a couple of teams, they hated Java, they wanted to do Node.js, and others hated Java and they wanted to do Go. And we were like, okay, you know, if you hate it, then, I mean, whatever hating a technology means, well, three technologies is fine. And then there was another one who said, we can only work with Python. And we cannot use Kubernetes. We have to use serverless, which, you know, we just let it happen. But it was, you know, there is basically, there was no business need for it. It was just people like it. And that was the reason to give them more freedom and think, yeah, well, okay. We don't want to force you into something.
I think that programming language, I think, is really difficult to have too many of. So I'm fine with people are using Node for front end and they're using Go or they're using Java for back end. But once you have both Go and Java, you're starting to think, well, why can't we just have one? It just makes things a lot. It means that your platform team can build tooling and they can build you libraries and they can do all of these things that would speed you up. It's one of the things that's really interesting about AI, though, is platform teams had this idea that you're paving the road and people will stick on the common set of things that you have suggested because it's painful to go off and do it another way. Like the idea that, you use our paved road and you don't have to be doing all the upgrades and you don't have to be doing all this stuff. Or it's going to be interesting to me when anyone can go away and use Claude Code to write the version of the library in their language or whatever quite quickly in theory. Does that pain work anymore? Does it keep people on the paved road or do you get even more of an explosion of, I've decided I'm going to write this in Ruby because I like Ruby?
Yeah, not sure.
So I think it's I think that you don't want to stop people from trying new things, but also you want to put a little bit of friction in the way. I mean, you said earlier we'd talk about tech governance group. Well, one of the things I liked about this approach, the idea was this is a group where you come and you present about things that are like the significant technology choices, and you have to decide what you mean by significant. But if you had to create a two-page document to explain, this is the problem we've got, here are the other things that we've considered, one of them always had to be doing nothing, what's the situation if we do nothing? And it was amazing to me how often I would say to people, yeah, sure, you can try this new technology, but you have to come to the tech governance group and fill out this page. They'd be like, oh, and it just wouldn't happen. They'd write a two-page document to use the technology they really wanted to use. Just didn't happen. It was a good friction.
Yeah, I think I love the idea of the TGG, and but maybe you can dive a little bit deeper into the tech governance group, the forum, the process, what's in the document you were describing, because I think it's interesting for everyone. And it's also a bit stolen. I must make some other, let's say, advertisement for books. Some parts are stolen from Andrew Harmel Law's book.
I mean, right? No, because it was way before his book.
Oh, it was before his book. Okay. Yeah. Oh, nice. Yeah.
I love because his book. I love his book. But this is a.
You also
honest,
made the foreword, right? So
I did. To be honest, borrow our ideas from other people. We learned from people who were doing architectural decision records. We learned from people who were using RFCs. My colleague Rob Godfrey did a lot of the work in defining this, but we basically said we want to have a useful forum where we can talk about architectural decisions and have a record of the decisions that we made and also make sure everyone understands why they were happening. So it had an RFC style document that you had to fill out that said, okay, here's the problem, here's why we're choosing this. And the important thing was, if you were bringing something to the group, it was your job to go around and get consensus before the meeting. So actually all the work happened pretty much before the meeting. You'd go and talk to anyone who, and this is where Andrew's book is brilliant, and it says, you know, work out who's affected by this decision and work out who has useful knowledge that can can fit into this decision. So you would go and talk to those people naturally. You talk to the people who've got opinions and the people who need to be on, you need to have on side. And so by the time we would get to our meeting, in theory, everyone's been consulted and they've looked at the document and they've made comments and there's been some iteration. So generally, by the time the meeting happened, it was the final tidying up and the communication of it. And one of my principal engineers came to the meeting for the first time and said, but it just felt like you just were just announcing the decision. It's like, yeah, all the work happens beforehand, but the meeting is about the communication. Because once the pandemic started, we said to any engineer that wanted to come along to the meeting could come, and we'd have 50 or 60 people joining the call just to hear people talking about architectural decisions and how you make them.
Yeah. You said previously writing this document, which already was a barrier or too much friction for a lot of people. Why is that? I mean, is it really that you don't, you see a technology and then you think, oh yeah, this sounds cool, let's do it, without even thinking about why do we need it? How much does it cost? What benefits does it bring?
I think people naturally are very enthusiastic about new technology, and we all love to learn. And there is a little bit of friction and being asked, well, what problem is it solving? And sometimes people just don't even do not want to be having to make that case. And I think that it's a good friction. Go away and try it in your own time, build things with it if you want, but if you're going to introduce it into the organization where it could be in this organization way after you've left, then I really, really want to have a sense that we've thought about it and we've considered alternatives.
That's true.
Every organization's got every organization's got the equivalent of this test suite's written in Scala because an engineer that was here 5 years ago loved Scala.
Yeah, but I still think it's so hard to control, right? So the client I was talking about, we thought we have four languages. But then it turned out there are many more languages for some, like you say, testing tools, for some tools. And I was like, why do we have this tool written in Clojure? And then I asked the guy and he was exactly like this. You know, I love Clojure. It's my favorite tool. Okay, so who is maintaining this library? It's me. Everyone else doesn't like Clojure. I was like, okay, but if you leave, what are we going to do then?
Precisely. So, and that happened. It's happened to me that someone who wrote a test library in Scala, once they left, the whole set of tests got rewritten into another language. I can't even remember what now. But this is why I think some thought about big decisions. And I think a programming language is it's a reasonable decision. It has impacts. So the things that I would want people to bring to the tech governance group would be anything that has an impact beyond their team, anything that's kind of like, are you trying to introduce something that we have a pretty standard way of doing it, and it might affect other teams because you maybe don't want to have two. So, oh yeah, we've got a CDN. You want to try a new CDN. Okay, so we have to have a theory for what happens if it's really good. Are we moving everybody onto it or are we supporting two forever? Because there's not often a lot of thought about that. And as a director of a platform engineering team, one of the things that I found really interesting was the number of times someone would turn up and say, hey, could you take over this technology? Because we don't want to be the ones that own it anymore. And you, as a platform team, you're sort of going, well, we already have a thing that does that.
Exactly. Yeah, I also experienced that, I must say. Unfortunately, then people want help and you have to say, sorry, I cannot help you. We're busy with our stuff and we just cannot look at this technology. Yeah, but then it's too late. I just want to avoid the too late moment.
I think you have to have the conversation. So, I was chatting about this a couple of years ago with Matthew Skelton, who wrote Team Topologies, and we were talking about the idea that you harvest ideas from within the company. And I was basically saying, I think there's got to be a decision as a platform team that you're okay to take something. And for me, there's a there's a barrier there. So I would be saying, is it documented? Does it have tests? And surprisingly often, people want to give you something where there's just nothing. There's code, there's no tests, there's no documentation. They're asking you to turn this into a proper thing. And I feel like that's like, I'll take it over if you've already done the work, but you know, you're asking me to do your homework.
Yeah. Okay. So now tech governance group. You have to bring in those, let's say, new ideas. Yeah. You think, oh, this is cool. I thought about it. I talked to everyone else. But probably I only use it in my team, not in the whole organization. And I think it's good, you know, you just start small. But how do I? So one question is, how can I keep the overview of things we briefly introduced in one team and more? And then when it spreads, the typical answer is the technology radar, to me at least. And you also mentioned it. And I, you know, I like the idea. It sounds good, but I'm, you know, I'm usually overwhelmed by all the proposals I get, and to manage all the things in the technology radar. So what are your recommendations when it comes to technology radar?
So I like the idea. We didn't use it at the FT. But I like idea of it, and I think it is a good way of doing it. We had what we called the tech hub that detailed all of the core capabilities offered by platform engineering. So that that would talk about the technologies that are kind of sanctioned and useful for everybody. We had invested in knowing what we had in our system. So there was a thing called BizOps that had list. We had many, many microservices at the FT, like thousands. So we needed to have a list of all of the microservices. We needed to know other services that we had. We needed to know what we had, so that we had a chance of going, well, okay, we've got Java and we've got Go, we've got these logging tools. Here's the technology that they're using. So we had that central idea of like, here are commonly used things. We definitely knew there were some things that were being used elsewhere that we maybe weren't so aware of. It is, I think, very difficult to be entirely on top of everything that's being used somewhere in your software estate. Because there'll be some stuff being trialed somewhere by someone.
Exactly. Yeah.
but we had some things that worked. So you couldn't go live on in our hosting platforms without a unique system code, and you couldn't get that unique system code unless you'd entered a record into this system registry, system catalog. So at least we would know that this thing existed when people were building stuff, and we'd know who owned it, and that becomes quite important. But yeah, I do think it's extremely hard. And I've been in the other extreme where you only were able to choose from a very small set of technology. And that was very painful. It meant that there were quite a few cases where we were using the wrong technology because there was only one thing that was approved, and it just wasn't the right tool for the problem we were trying to solve. So I feel like I'd rather there was more freedom to introduce new stuff.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we have this all the time, very conservative organizations where you are extremely limited in your choice, and then you have to talk a lot to get a broader choice. And then it's just the other extreme, where everything goes. Yeah, I immediately thought about one client. They had everything had to be web scale, so they used Cassandra. But they had no Cassandra problems. You know, they had very few users and they needed strong consistency.
Yes.
So, and there was no way to get out. You have to use Cassandra. Yeah. And that's really something you want to avoid. But probably the right choice is, as you said in the beginning, right? So do we have something similar which solves the problem? No. Okay. Then let's take it.
And if you do want to try it, maybe we have something similar. You need to explain why it's not, why you think it's not the right thing for you. And then, like, often people are right. It is actually correct that there is a better solution for your particular use case that is slightly different. But you do have to understand what's going to happen in 5 years' time. Are we both? Is that going to exist? And we'll also have something else.
Yeah. Yeah, probably it's also a way to control the amount of technologies. I still think the radar or this, what you say, you said the technology lock, or what was the name you used?
Well, a system catalog is quite...
System catalog,
yeah. So Backstage does that as part of what it does. Ours was homegrown because we were doing it before Backstage existed. It's just, honestly, you can use a spreadsheet. You just need to have something that says, here's what we've got and here's who owns each part of it and here's the technology that's being used. And you've got a chance of being able to work out what exists.
Yeah. So I think, okay, so if I use a spreadsheet tomorrow, then we have the technologies, who is using it, what business problem does it solve?
Yeah.
We have something similar, yes, no. Yeah, I mean, I think it's okay to have a lot of things in parallel, right? Because some technologies are older, but you cannot just get rid of them all the time. And,
it's true, but you do need to have a plan at some point. Because I think there will be a period where you've got multiple technologies running in parallel. But I've gone into quite a few clients where... The question you ask is, so what's your plan? How is this going to change? You're using two different technologies. Are you all going to move on to technology A? You know, you're going to, it's like what happens in a migration is interesting. You introduce a new technology, presumably you'll migrate away from the old technology at some point. What's the decision for that?
Oh, but that, I think that's a hard question, right? So if I'm fully into COBOL, I mean, that's an extreme case, right? But if I have some older web framework and it's very expensive to move away to a new web framework, probably.
Yeah, I think the important thing is to have the conversation early. So to have the conversation where someone says, I want to introduce this new web framework, you want to have a conversation early about, if it is successful, what's the plan? Are we planning to move everyone to it? Are we planning to keep everything else? Like, I like one of the advantages of microservices is you don't have to migrate everything. We moved to using Go at the FT in my team, and we left all of the Java services that were already working fine. Because who needs to go and rebuild 20 services that are effectively complete?
Yeah.
But at some point, there'll need to be a decision about, do you want to be supporting these Java services when you don't have any developers in your organization who write Java anymore? Because everything that's been written in the last 5 years is written in Go. Maybe you need to think about, are we going to rebuild those? Are we going to port them over?
True.
No one wants to do this stuff, though. You don't want to be the team that has to spend 6 months doing migrations, because it just means that no one's talking about you in a positive way and you're not delivering new features or new products.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, or you live with it, right? So maybe, you know, when I think about the ThoughtWorks technology radar idea that you're on hold.
Yeah.
I think on hold is... I just learned the on hold was not very clear. You know, everyone had a different opinion about it. Does it mean we want to get rid of it? Or we, like in your example, we just don't continue with the technology?
Yeah. Well, I think it probably covers both. And I actually think that knowing which of the two it is really important. You know, we're not building new things using this versus we have a plan to have nothing running on this technology by a set date. They're very different.
Yeah, it was actually a fun idea of a colleague of mine. He introduced a website, Worst of Breed. So Worst of Breed, I don't know if you if you ever looked at it.
You shared the link and I thought it was great.
Yeah. So the idea is we kind of anonymize like really bad decisions, technology decisions, architectural decisions. But there is one thing in it. It's the Tech Horror Radar, which is kind of fun. You know, it has something like you have to remove immediately. It's too late, you know, full disaster, resignation. We need to live with it. But I find it quite useful because sometimes you really cannot get rid of old technology and you have to have a way to deal with the old stuff nobody wants anymore, and also to categorize it to say, yeah, we have this in Go, we have this Java stuff, and we don't continue. But we also have this technology, and we have to remove it immediately because it turned out to be really bad.
Yeah.
Or it's too late, we just have to live with it. Yeah.
And I think those decisions for an organization are really important. And part of the decision is, if you are going to keep this technology there, you know, we're not usually building new things on it. Are you looking at your people and hiring to make sure you can still do it? So I have been in an organization doing consultancy where there'd been a decision, we're moving away from a particular technology, but they still had large numbers of services written in a previous technology, but no one could touch them because they didn't understand. They had been hiring for a different language. No one really understood it. It's a real risk. And I think in a sense, in a well-run organization, you ought to be saying, okay, we're going to build everything now in Node, but we're going to maintain these services in this other language, which means we need to keep 20 people who can write that code, and we need to work on it because I think it's a big risk. We at the Financial Times, we had a service that was the only, like pretty much the only production service that was written in PHP. I think it was PHP, and there was almost no one in the organization that knew it. And we at some point said, well, we could get rid of this service. It's tiny. It doesn't do a great deal. And we started looking into it and discovered that it brought in a lot of money. So at that point, we hired a team to rewrite it in a language that we could support. Mm. Because we had decided there were business reasons to maintain it. Having it in PHP was a risk. Yeah. And it was worth doing that migration. But it's only when you have those conversations that, honestly, no one's excited about having a conversation about this stuff. But I used to do operations. Like I was in charge of operations and platform engineering at the FT. So one of the things you ought to be thinking about is how do we support this system that no one knows?
Now, yeah. One final question, and I should have asked this in the beginning, but somehow we took a few turns. One colleague of mine, he says, well, you know, the major or the biggest task, the most important task of a CTO or principal engineer, he is also a principal engineer, is to select technology. And I was like, yeah, when you say so, it's true. Yeah, I think you're the CTO. You probably have to think about technology. It's in your name, but it's, you know, if you use the hive, like you described it, you know, everyone can propose technologies. That's probably better. Yeah.
I think it depends on the organization. So I've not worked in the kind of organization where the CTO is making these big technology decisions, or rather, they're not coming up with the options. They are making the call, but they're expecting someone else to come in there and say, here are the options and do that thinking. I think that you want to harness everybody's ideas and experience. And I'm looking for the CTO to be making the really big strategic decisions about, are we moving into the cloud? It's quite a while ago, but there was, you know, someone's going to make that decision. Yeah, now are we moving out of the cloud? Are we concerned that we're using a technology that doesn't seem to be very actively maintained anymore? Is there a risk there? Those kinds of things are where I'm thinking that CTO should be saying, this seems like a risk to us as an organization. And so what are our options? But I think there are different CTOs. If you're in a smaller organization, yeah, they probably do have that focus on like understanding the whole of your estate and where you're trying to go strategically.
Yeah, probably now it's... I know some companies who say you're not allowed to touch code anymore. I mean, people are scared, like new hires. Oh, I have to I have to write prompts and I don't know the code base. Yeah, well, big strategic decision.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, yeah, you have to go, unfortunately. Yeah, definitely. Thank you very much for the conversation. Yeah, for everyone else, for all the listeners, buy the book, watch your talks, and yeah, hope to see you soon at some GoTo conference.
Definitely, it will be a pleasure. I really loved speaking at GoTo Copenhagen last year. It was great.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very
Cheers.
Much. Thanks. Goodbye.